Hi, my name's Neil Jackson. I played Marcus van Sciver on the Blade TV series, and you're listening to the Dead TV podcast.
Welcome back to the Dead TV podcast dedicated to ending all science fiction, fantasy, and comic book related superhero horror shows. And we are at the end of Blade. I'm your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And we say goodbye to Blade in these two episodes, and we say hello to our interview with the actor who played Van Sciver, which is fantastic. So look forward to that at the end of this podcast. It will be sandwiched in with this, kind of like our Nancy Butler interview, which has been getting some traction, and a couple people have asked me to email because they can't find it on the website. I get it. You're going to have to scroll through a bunch of things or whatever. Yancey Butler's Witchblade, the Witchblade comic book is up to issue, is the Witchblade comic book is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, Mr. Seneca.
Ooh.
Yes.
Wow.
1995, Witchblade with Sarah Pazzini debuted and ran for 150 issues, and then they ended it. And then they did like a reboot with a new bearer. It didn't take very well. It was canceled after 13 issues. And now we're up to issue 15 of the current ongoing reimagining Witchblade universe. New take on the Witchblade. Same thing. Sarah's a detective. Gets the Witchblade. In a new kind of direction. And they're launching The Darkness soon, which is Jackie Estacado, which spins off a Witchblade.
Nice.
Yeah. So in our coverage of Witchblade, the TV show has been talked about a bunch. So, and we interviewed Nancy Butler for that canceled show. Back
she was
the
just lovely.
Yes, she was fantastic. As Mr. Zeneca says, I was gushing all over her.
You were.
You were.
Oh my god.
Yes, and then when we did War of the Worlds, I got Mr. Zeneca back because she was gushing all over the Highlander.
That is true.
Yes,
that is true.
Being like, I was 14 years old. I ran home to watch this gorgeous man with a sword just hacking people to pieces.
I mean, he's the Highlander. Come on.
And you
know?
Were 14 years old. I'm sure it was your version of internet pornography. Scrambled porn, you know, what 14-year-olds would watch.
Well, I'm sure there are people out there that have watched the Blade television series or the other media that Neil Jackson has been in and have drooled all over him as well, because he is very drool-worthy.
Yeah, he does not age at all, especially when he played Icicle on Stargirl, which we get into as well, which is where he was a Nazi on that show.
Yeah.
Not a good role to play these days, but that's okay. We're here to talk about Blade, the last two episodes. We have episode 12 with Mr. Zeneca's plot synopsis.
12 and 13. Kind of a double episode. Conclave. Originally aired September 13th, 2006. Marcus plans a full-scale attack on the pureblood vampires as they gather to celebrate their ultimate triumph, and Marcus prepares to execute his apocalyptic plan. This is definitely a very interesting set of circumstances we have for our finales.
One of the other people we tried to reach out to was Charlotte, who's all grown up now. I mean, she was a little girl on the show. She was like 12 or 13 years old. And we also tried to reach out to Larry Poindexter, who plays our hapless cop character who we say goodbye to. And that just unfortunately didn't work out. But I will maybe try and have him on Radio of Horror just to talk about his time on Blade. But we do have a great one great actor from the show on with us, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, Neil Jackson.
Hmm.
Stay tuned for that interview.
Charlotte's whole look of the kind of like Wednesday Addams vampire is very cute and adorable.
And she always wears those gloves, too.
Very interesting. Wonder why.
Yeah. I don't know.
Vampires don't like to get their hands dirty.
Perhaps not. And she's pure blood, so she, you know, feels that she's above all of the other infected people. And that is what they're being punished for basically being, like this ruling class of vampire that no other vampire on Earth could actually live up to because they're not pure blood.
Why did the plane crash? It goes from a scene of like the close-ups of the faces to a couple doing a hiking, backpacking, camping thing to the plane crashing. It's all very jarring.
Okay, so what I gather happened is that as Charlotte is inspecting the case that Chase gave her with Blade's sword, there was something inside the case or around the case that was a bomb. And so I thought actually Chase had put the bomb there, and that is why it exploded. But it doesn't seem to be like that in the very end. So the bomb got on the plane, and I thought it was just part of the whole case where Blade's sword was. Or it could have been actually Blade's sword, but it didn't really seem to be that. It was a very, very quick cut. So you're right to be confused.
Very confused. I was just so like, what? Felt like there was a scene missing.
Maybe there was. Charlotte and her servant survived the crash. I'm not sure why it's automatically assumed that they would have died in a plane crash, because it seemed that like Chase survived far worse burns. They were barely touched. And they ended up eating those two hikers you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yummy. They had Chinese takeout. there's a weird thing I had to do multiple double takes for. When the credits roll up in the beginning, when Blade is talking to Shen, it says executive producers. And I thought it said Ari Arad twice, or Avi Arad. And I was like, no, it's Ari Arad and Avi Arad. He is the guy responsible for bringing the Marvel Cinematic Universe along, but started with like Spider-Man and X-Men. He was the one who was involved with like making sure Marvel got out of the bankruptcy, got himself involved in the 90s, and then making sure like we got like films in theaters of our Marvel characters, Daredevil, the X-Men, Spider-Man, Ang Lee's Hulk. So before the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and then Kevin Feige took over, and he's been like an executive producer behind the scenes ever since. He still shows up on the red carpet, but his handling of it is just non-existent anymore these days because we have Kevin Feige.
Are Ari and Avi related?
Yes, I believe it's a son and father. It's kind of like... I believe it's like the two Middle Eastern Israeli executives that were behind the Salkinds, Russian, behind Superman. Mexican.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mexican. They were Mexican filmmakers. They were behind the Iliad and Iliad and his son were the executives behind the Christopher Reeve Superman films.
Oh,
as well as Superboy, the TV series, which we will never cover. There's enough Superman podcasts out there that have covered it.
Yeah.
We're probably going to stay away from comic books for quite some time.
Well, we're going to be doing the Dark Crystal Age of Resistance and then the Dark Crystal movie, which follows that in succession with their timeline. So, you know, we'll have to choose what the next series we're going to do after that.
Yes, but... no comic books for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moving on.
Okay, so Charlotte and her servant are basically walking through the forest until they find a little town, and they basically chew down on everyone that is preparing for the pancake breakfast at their local school, and they just basically eat everyone and turn them all into vampires.
Which is like, why? Is so we can have a little army to fight Blade, I guess? It just seems kind of silly.
I think so, yeah. And that's why Detective Collins, after he gets stabbed in the hustle and tussle, it decides to become bait. Because if he's occupying the army that is supposed to be fighting Blade, then Blade can just focus on Charlotte, which is what he did. And Charlotte does not survive this episode.
No, which is sad. She could have went on to do other great things. But, I mean, how much of that lasted, the show being canceled?
True. We did see, though, Charlotte's major superpowers. Like, she can wall climb like a mofo. like a little spider girl. She was just like crawling all over the walls. And she has, because her outside vision is so young looking, she was able to trick Detective Collins pretty easily. So that I would consider that a major power for her.
Detective Collins tried so hard and failed so miserably.
Yeah, his heart was in the right place, but unfortunately, he was bitten and didn't want to be turned, so Blade actually killed him.
Just kind of like trying to get the actor Larry on the show with us.
Oh, well, that too. Yeah, we went through a whole lot of rigmarole and appointments and cancellations and just couldn't make it happen.
No, we really couldn't. It's just funny they had this character build up so much to, you know, hunt Blade, not really hunt him, but trying to piece together the information to, you know, solve his case, and it just didn't like work out. That I guess, you know, they didn't need him past the season if they were thinking about, ooh, we're gonna do season two if we get picked up, because they obviously I'll have that all mapped out prior to the pickup or not. So
yeah, that death didn't really have the gravitas of usually a character build up this much. Like, he was in what, 8 episodes? So that is a long time to just build up this mystery of a character and just to toss him away as being bait. I would have liked to see him be a major character in the second season.
I also do like the visual effect of whatever they put on the actress who played Chase's finger to cut open
Krista's
abdomen between her breasts. Because that is obviously a prosthetic, and there's something on her finger that allows her to slice open the prosthetic.
Mm.
Not CGI.
Special effects.
It's definitely not CGI. It's definitely okay. Because you can see the pigmentation around the cut wound happening.
Okay.
So it's some type of prosthetic on her abdomen while she is pretty much almost naked, you know? And it's supposed to be a dynamic lesbian play, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Very clearly, you know, like, sexy vampire women touch each other. Ooh.
Well, yeah, because Krista is naked and she's only wearing the locket, uh-huh. And Chase is jealous, mm-hmm. because she didn't get the locket. She wasn't deemed worthy enough to get the locket. Why does Krista have the locket?
Right.
And so she ends up, you know, just saying that she's better as a friend rather than being her enemy, which is probably very true because Chase is very cutthroat in multiple senses of that word. But she just kind of puts on a robe on Krista while Krista's just standing there naked. So it's very filled with a lot of undertones in that scene.
Well, not just that. I mean, just Tony. I mean, she kisses her on the mouth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's, you get a lesbian lip lock.
Yeah, but there's also a burning hatred underneath that. You know, there's a lot of things going on in that exchange.
Doesn't matter. It's Spike TV. It was the man's network. We want to see girls making out on the man's network.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think a network like that could exist today. I just don't think it would fly very well.
I don't know. The next 3 years are going to be something, man.
Well, yeah, I guess we could get a man's network. You know, we have a man's country. I mean, unfortunately. I don't see that happening because of politics, honestly. I think that would be bounced up against pretty hard. So, I don't see it. This eventually became the El Rey network, by the way. And I don't think that exists anymore either.
Okay.
So, that's how it ends, with some lesbian action on Blade, and then we switch over to the final episode, Conclave.
And it's the same description, sure, it's a two-part episode, IMDb does not have this episode on there.
No, so. it's kind of a two-parter, so.
Exactly. So this one actually begins with Marcus inspecting the Conclave and the architect's work.
This is not the first time Blade's hideout has been broken into by vampires. Look at the movie with Whistler.
Yeah, yeah, no, every time the Blade sets up some sort of getaway, his hideout, his base of operations, the vampires find it because, of course, they're trying to kill him while Blade is trying to kill them. So it's this round and round cat and mouse type of game that they play. And, you know, Blade gets his technology destroyed every movie at least once.
Yeah, but I guess he has stolen enough money from the people to...
Really say how he funds this.
Yeah, in the movie he does.
Okay.
They rip off vampires.
Okay.
They literally steal from vampires. Because Karen, the hematologist that he saves, says, "Are you going to rob me too?" And he goes, How do you think we fund this little operation? Something from humanity. It's like some kind of weird charity. If you listen to the Vampire Movie Minute podcast, I had to look up the charity and explain what the charity is. It's some kind of Christian charity he makes a joke at, like the Salvation Army or something. You know what I mean? And he's like, because he rips off a Rolex off a vampire's arm.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And then later on, he's at a pawn store giving a guy a bunch of Rolexes, and the guy gives him a bunch of like serum.
Okay.
So.
Well, in the very next scene, Chase kidnaps Shen. And then Krista has to torture him. Because if she doesn't torture him, then her cover is blown. And it's really obvious that she's working with Blade. So Shen has to put up with having his fingernails peeled off. Yikes.
Fun for everybody. Have you ever had to do that with somebody you've tortured?
I mean, I've had artificial nails, and sometimes just taking those off can be quite painful. But taking off your own fingernails, like, that is classic torture. Like, it is no beans about it. That is painful.
But nobody's, like, hired you to do that to them?
No. I don't know anyone who has sexualized that type of pain.
Oh, I'm shocked.
You know, certain types of pain is very difficult to kind of have some sort of fetishize for. You know, like needles underneath your fingernails is one of those things that's very, very difficult and very, very rare. I've never seen anyone have some sort of like enjoyment from that specific type of pain.
There was a documentary that came out in, like, 2012. I don't remember the name of it, but it's all about this, like, website that was all sexually kind of pornographic material. I wouldn't say there was a lot of fucking in it. It was definitely of the modeling kind, but it was a lot of, like, torture sexual stuff. Mm-hmm. And the documentary is about like the site getting shut down and like them being brought up on charges, even though nobody was actually arrested for anything. And, you know, they had all these the contracts and all the signatures they needed to prove mm-hmm. that nobody was being held against their will or tortured against their will. They signed up for this. You know what I mean? It was a lot of like, you know, caged waterboarding kind of stuff with like naked models, things like that. You know what I mean? There was nobody being like even play raped or whatever you want to call it, you know, no fantasy like that, but it was a lot of torture with sex. Yeah. So, that's why I'm like surprised that, you know, you haven't encountered that.
No, not in my real life. Yeah. I could take a look at things online or pornos or whatnot as things that might've gotten close. But honestly, if it's for a video camera, then I don't really consider that someone's honest feelings, because you could be doing that and just suffering through it for the paycheck. And I'm sure a lot of the people that were doing the torture porn videos do that for the paycheck, not that they are pure masochists and enjoy the aspect of pain for the pain pleasure itself. So, yeah, but in real life, I've never seen anyone enjoy pain to quite that extent.
Who is the lady who looks like a slightly older Kirsten Dunst, who is clearly naked in this scene, but Spike TV is a bridge too far to show complete nudity with the tattoo on her butt? Because I don't know. I don't even think she gets a name either, does she?
Well, there's a couple people that it could be. There's the concubine familiar, who's played by Caroline Carter.
She blonde.
Or there's Minion, mm-hmm. played by Angelique Nod.
Mm, okay.
One of those two, perhaps.
It's quite the sexy scene.
Yeah.
Minion sounds right. Of course, she's got on her IMDb She's got like black hair in a lot of her other photos. She's got black hair, so bridge too far that it's her. I mean, she could be wearing a wig, but pretty much seems to be a brunette. Also, the face looks different, so it's probably the other one who doesn't have an IMDb photo.
Yeah, Caroline Carter.
Mm.
Yeah, and that concubine familiar was given to the architect as a gift for completing the upgrades on the conclave building itself. And he put in a retina scanning device as part of the security system. And that was one of his downfalls, because he loses an eye to Blade because he needs to access that system. And so he has his eyeball cut out.
Yikes.
Yummy.
Not fun.
No, and you know, the weird thing is that actual eyeballs, once they get out of, they stop being living eyeballs, they will actually liquefy very quickly. Fun fact.
Mm, must know this from experience.
Well, like cow eyeballs, you know, they liquefy. You know, the eyes and the brain are some of the first things to liquefy in a dead corpse.
Ew, gross.
Yep.
This circular room that they're in kind of reminds me of like the ending of the first Blade movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Maybe there was some callback to it.
Possibly.
Because this is supposed to be a very sacred area.
Yeah. The sword fight between Marcus and Blade is okay. It just feels like they're just waving the swords around. As somebody who's taken German longsword fighting, it's mm-hmm. like they could have hired someone a little better.
There's a lot of quick cuts to make it even more exciting of a battle than it was.
Right. What point in the episode do you think Marcus figured out that Kristen's working with Blade?
The torture scene.
Okay.
Because I think he knew just before that, but that was confirmation.
Do you think Chase was actually killed off?
No, absolutely not.
Just taking a header?
Yeah. Chris is shoving Chase off of, what was that, maybe 5 stories?
Many more
staircase.
Stories than 5. Gotta be like a dozen.
Maybe, but she survived being burned alive in that one building, the medical facility.
True.
Like, and she was severely burned.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
and
definitely.
Fire is, like, very bad for vampires.
It's very bad for human beings, too. Just an FYI, a stake through the heart could kill anything.
So, like, but there wasn't any broken wood. She just hit her head, hit her body, hit her flailing limbs on the way down. So, yeah, she totally has survived way worse than that.
I want to
re-edit. She's definitely alive.
I want to re-edit the episode and put in pinball machine sounds as she falls.
Oh, ping, 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 yeah.
We ever have a chance to talk to that actress, then we'll have to ask her about that scene. We didn't ask our guest about the fight scene with Blade when he thought of it, did we?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either, yeah. But that's okay.
Yeah, no. And then basically the end of the episode, which cuts off on a cliffhanger, is, you know, Marcus revealing to Krista that he knows that she is working with Blade.
Dun, dun, dun.
But
we'll never know what happens next. But you can listen to our interview with the actor who plays Marcus. Because we were that smooth to get it.
He was great. He was absolutely amazing and called me mistress.
That was an easy get. That was shockingly very easy to get. That wasn't a struggle like with some of the other ones. Which is.
And he loves to play villains, and I love to see him as a villain.
He definitely loves his villains, which is great.
Yeah.
Because he's definitely played a few. And then you can hear more about what he's been up to and what he's doing in our interview.
Yeah. That's all the notes I have for this episode.
Yeah.
You know, the purebloods get liquefied and Marcus has Krista, Blade has Shen, goes to fight another day until the... Missing season 2.
Well, that's all our time for Blade and how we loved it. You know, Blade kind of continues right now in Marvel Comics. There is no Blade in the cinematic universe due to just whatever reason, they just cannot get Blade going. I there is a giant story to be told about that, and I guarantee somebody is waiting to tell it once their NDA is over, you know?
Perhaps.
Hmm. We tried with Kirk Sticky Smith Jones as well. Unfortunately, he wanted way too much money to come on the show.
Yeah, this show does not have a budget.
Not for what he wanted, so we're going to jump over to the fantasy realm of one Jim Henson, or at least his legacy, as Jim Henson passed away back in 1990, right? I think he was 44 years old, if you can believe that.
Yeah, we will be doing the Dark Crystal Age of Resistance, a Netflix show that is beautifully produced. Oh my God. The puppetry is amazing. It takes you right into it. I definitely recommend everyone seeing it at least once because the puppetry is just, oh, absolutely amazing. Gorgeous. And I will be giving some deep dives on the characters, and I bought a whole bunch of books on the lore and mythology of the kingdom or the land of Thra. So I will be reading all of that so you don't have to. And then you will understand everything about the Dark Crystal world as I understand it.
Which also unfortunately got canceled, so.
Yes, canceled after one season.
And canceled very quickly, too. Just one of those Netflix shows that was canceled very fast, so. But I have an idea for another show after this, which will also be a Netflix show, which was canceled before it even got to Netflix. It got canceled, if you can believe that.
Which show?
I was thinking about possibly Cowboy Bebop.
Based on the
anime.
Do you have to actually have seen the anime to watch the remake?
I mean, it helps, but no, I don't think so. I think the live action show looked just like the anime.
I don't know. I've not seen Cowboy Bebop. I'm not so much an anime fan.
Gotcha. Well, we'll figure it out in March, as we will be on for five recording sessions of Dark Crystal, and we'll start that in Dark Crystal December, as I like to call it. Puns are funny. Thank you for tuning into the Dead TV Podcast. Hopefully you had a good Halloween. Hopefully you have a good Thanksgiving in between this, and look for our episode with our actor coming up shortly.
Good night.
Thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about Blade the series and everything else that you got currently coming up and that you're working on, Neil Jackson.
Hello, mate.
We're so happy to have
you on the show.
Oh, thank you, mistress.
You were.
It's never not going to be funny me calling you mistress. I'm going to get a little private kick out of it every time.
That's great. I love it.
You were saying that. Just before we got started recording, you were saying that you're working on a JFK project, but you're also you also worked with Oliver Stone once, but haven't seen them film JFK.
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to work with Oliver Stone. Very first movie I ever did, 20 whatever it would be years ago, 25 maybe, on Alexander. So the story about Alexander the Great with Colin Farrell, Angelina Jolie, Val Kilmer, and worked on that for 6 months, which. Very first film I've ever done. So, I mean, it's just like, what a ridiculous experience to have as my first film to be on this massive $200+ million project. So it was massive by those standards back then. Now we get several $300 million coming in, but 20 plus years ago, that was a huge one. And just to be standing on these immense sets with these incredible actors that I've admired for such a long time. And then Oliver Stone, who's just a master. That was my very first film.
It's funny you mentioned that the Alexanders being such a big kind of epic Trojan kind of war film style sands. What's it called? Swords and Sandals.
Swords and Sandals, yeah.
Next year, they already have pre-tickets coming up for Christopher Nolan's Odyssey. And that's supposed to be the most expensive movie they think ever made coming up.
Right. Well, it's a story that, I mean, like, nobody's really done or done well, I think. Like, Troy was an interesting film, and I enjoyed a lot of Troy. And they played very fast and loose with the Iliad and what happened with it. But they captured it pretty well. But Odysseus is the character that I think is the most fascinating one, because Odysseus was essentially not only a general and so one of the smartest men alive. He was an inventor. He was the guy that created and came up with the idea of the Trojan horse. So it was his idea of how to finally get in. And the way he did that is he hid as a beggar and got into the walls of Troy and hung around everybody and got a sense of the place and the revere that they had for iconography and gods and everything else like that, and came up with the idea of the Trojan horse. And then when he finally finished the battle, which itself was a 10-year campaign, and all of that's hilarious because you hear about a 10-year campaign, but they were only fighting for about 4 years. The Greeks came over and attacked Troy, and then once they'd sacked it, they realized they got the wrong place. So they sacked the wrong city originally. And then they had to figure out, hang on, how do we get this wrong? And actually find Troy and then sack it again the second time. And Odysseus, this wonderful character who was this general who left his young born son and his wife in their on their island, took 10 years to get home because he kept being pulled off on side quests and things that the gods were doing, and fighting the Cyclops and encountering the harpies and all the various different stuff they did. So I'm fascinated at that journey. There's a Ralph Fiennes film that came out either this year or end of last year called The Return, which is about Odysseus and as an old man returning finally home and the challenges he has when he gets home. And so that's a really interesting one about when he finally gets home. But I mean, we use it in pop culture now of just the idea that this is any journey that seems prolonged or protracted is, you know, this is my odyssey. This is my odyssey. And that all comes from Odysseus from that 10-year journey home. So I'm fascinated to see what he does with that. And of course, Chris Nolan can pretty much do no wrong.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's true.
Although he's chosen, I mean, I think that Matt Damon is an amazing actor. And again, he can do no wrong. But it was an interesting choice in my mind to choose an American to play that role, because we normally think of those classic ones coming from Brits, and I've just never heard him do a convincing British accent. So it would be interesting to see what take they decide to go with it. Anyway, that's
My
my.
guess is that it would be no accent at all.
You think? Oh, just
I think he's just going to
speaking.
play it straight.
Oh, he's going to do it with speaking American. Okay. That's
We'll have
interesting.
to see
Number
how that
one.
all we'll have to see how that turns out. Talk about let's get to Blade the series. And it's just funny that you mentioned Colin Farrell, because he was a bad guy in the Marvel Cinematic Extended Universe. He
Bullseye.
was, of course, Bullseye. Yeah, and your Van Scriver,
I
which is
played.
funny. Is that named, by the way, after the comic book artist at the time who was very popular? It was. Okay, I thought so.
That's what they drew it off, and I only found that out towards the end of filming. Yeah, it was just this really interesting project. I'd only just moved to the States, and a year and a half before I'd finished Alexander. You hear me okay?
Yeah, you're just frozen.
Oh, okay. As long as you can hear me, just give me
Yeah.
like little waves if
You're
you feel
good.
anything. Yeah, I just moved to the States. I've been maybe a year and a half out from finishing Alexander, and this audition came in for Blade, and I was a huge fan of the Blade series. I liked all three of them, and I liked them in the ascending order. One is amazing, two is still fantastic, and three loses a little bit for me, but has an amazing quality in it. And I always loved the Blade universe, and they were doing this Blade TV series, and I saw that we had David Goyer was attached as lead writer, so his lineage of writing, he definitely wrote the last two, I think. I'm not sure if he wrote the first one, or maybe he was a writer on the first one. And so I had all the pedigree, and it had Marvel attached, and it seemed like a no-brainer. And then I read the script, and it was the lead vampire, reimagining this entire world. And just a delicious character to play, because it's one of those shows that I think if it came out now, it would have run for 9, 10 seasons. It just happened to come out at the time where people weren't doing superhero shows for TV as much. And it also came out on Spike TV, which was a fledgling cable company in the US. and it was the first scripted show that they'd ever done. They were known before that for things like Fear Factor and UFC. They had the rights to the UFC before Dana White took over and turned it into something else. And this was their first scripted show, and I just don't think they knew what to do with it. We were all expecting this was going to be something that was going to run and run. I originally signed on just for a one-year contract because the plan was that Marcus was going to die at the end of season one. He was going to be the big bag for season one. And it was going to open up the world and realize that there are levels to it. And he's just one level of an even deeper conspiracy to take over. Flatteringly, at the kind of three quarters way through shooting the season, they came up to me and said, "We're really loving the character and really loving what I'm doing with the character. And would I like to sign on for one more?" So I'd already signed on to do one more. And was really excited where that would have ended up. We were talking about what some of the plot points were going to be for season two, and then found out we didn't get the pickup order. But season, it was just an absolute blast. Shooting up in Vancouver, where I now live. Yeah, my first lead in a TV series in the US.
When you read the script, how much of it did you add your own personal take to? Or was his cool and calm, like elegant facade just ingrained into the script?
It's part ingrained into the script and part we found it. He was written as American.
Oh.
When I read it, I was told, and this happens often with actors, that you'll receive an audition side and they've already made offers out to people. So they've made offers out to named actors and you're kind of the backup. If all of that falls through, they want to have some tape options from other actors to see that they've got somebody to slot in. And it was written as American. And they had, his name's right on the tip of my tongue, it's Eric Roberts. Eric Roberts was originally going to be Marcus Van Sciver. For whatever reason, that didn't happen. And I got called back for another audition. Sure. And the second audition that I did was with the director, Peter. It's been a while since I've looked at everything. But the director of the pilot, Peter. We did the first take. I was a little more insecure with my accents back then. I'd only been in the States for probably 8 months. I always used to go into auditions just doing the full accent. I didn't want there to be any dissonance in the casting director or producer's ear of me hopping from British to American to British to American. I wanted them just to buy in whatever the character was. So I'd always go in and speak in American, hold on to the accent. We did the first take and Peter said to me, "Where are you originally from?" And I said, in the American accent, I said, "I'm from the UK." He said, "Can we just hear one with a British accent?" I was like, okay, we did one with a British accent and I saw the room relax and they went, "Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic." And he said, so I left and then they called me in for a screen test, but I was shooting another film where I was playing another vampire, could only get away on one day. And the screen test was on the day they were doing the screen test for the Blade and the Shen characters. So I went to 20th Century Fox, and it was just me and all of the Blades and all of the Shens. It's one of those auditions they don't tend to do anymore. The old school screen tests where you go into a room and I'd say there's maybe 35, 40 people in there and they go around the room and name everybody and it's execs from execs and marketing and this person's from this sect of the thing. And it's a very stark, cold room to walk into as a bunch of eyeballs who are staring at you, who are hoping that you're going to be the role, but they're about to do 10 Blades and 10 Shens following it. It's going to be a long day for them and they're all caffeinated. And they called me in before they did all the Blades and the Shens. And I did the audition. There was a wonderful banter in the room. And one of the producers, He asked a couple of questions about my home life and everything else like this. And then they just asked me to slow it down and just to give an air. I mean, the note was he's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old. Time doesn't mean much to him. Let everything just happen languidly. I think through a combination of moving him from American to British and slowing things down a little bit. And then once we finally got out there and we started looking at the clothes he was going to wear and these beautiful bespoke suits and we started getting a sense of everything, it all kind of came together as we were shooting the pilot. But yeah, they kind of found it on the page. He was a little faster and a little more American and a little more Eric Roberts. It makes sense they were going for that, that he was a little more energized and bombastic. And I really liked the direction they went with it with me.
I think it worked very well. It comes off as you're completely in control of the situation at all times. You're the head vampire, and it just has that energy to it. where no matter what the scene is, your attention is drawn to that character because of the quiet elegance of it.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's full credit to David Goyer and the script that he wrote. I mean, there's a wonderful scene in the pilot, which I loved shooting, but it came off the page as you imagine it would be, where Van Sciver walks out of this charity benefit and he's being held in the scopes of Krista Starr's rifle, I think it is. He knows where she is and he's talking to her on the headset, but just weaving around people so she can't get the shot. So he's just playing with her, and each time he emerges, he immediately disappears behind another person, and they don't realize that they're being a shield for him, and he's just toying and toying and toying, and that told me everything about the character. This guy is 12 steps ahead of everybody and knows what's going on at any one moment, and which was so much fun. And because I'd done Alexander before, we'd done a lot of sword training for Alexander, and I had a friend of mine in the US who was on Alexander, who was one of the sword and wrestling trainers. And so I started working with him with katanas once I knew I got the role. And it was about 2 months between getting the role and shooting. I started working with him with katanas and playing around with samurai swords. And then there's no samurai sword play in the pilot. You always knew at some point Van Sciver is going to have a sword fight with Blade. It's going to happen. And so, in between finding out whether we got the pickup order between the pilot and the show, which was about 4 months, I carried on working with him in the hope. And then we found an amazing sword master in Vancouver, Kirk Jakes, who worked with me and Sticky. And we would go in once a week and just play with sword fighting. And we got to showcase maybe 5% of it in the film. But it was really fun getting to kind of play with these characters, because the idea that if you have lived for that long, and you have the ability to pick up a skill, you can pretty much learn anything over the course of time. Spend 10 years on piano, spend 10 years on violin, spend 10 years on katana, spend, learn every accent. So what skills would they have got, and how good would they have gotten at these skills, as well as obviously having enhanced abilities? So the whole thing was just a joy.
Excellent.
Choose a, if you had to choose between Kristen or Chase, which one would you choose?
That's a tough one in that world. Probably Kristen, in the same way that that he does in the show, because Chase is a great soldier, but
He's
the
evil.
personality, which actually is evil. Yeah, there was we had a re and it's an enduring memory for me. There's loads of little bits of enduring memories of this. I'm blanking on the actress's name. Sorry, I should have done a little research before I came on. But anyway, the woman that played what's her name?
Kristen.
No, the other one,
Chase.
Chase. She had just had her baby. I remember her baby's name was Sequoia, and she just had her baby in just after shooting the just before shooting the pilot. And so we're
Jessica
shooting
Coyer,
this.
yeah.
Jessica, thank you, my goodness. Incredible actress, and she was maybe 5 months was Sequoia's age when we were shooting the series, and so she had the baby with her at all times. And there was a scene in one of the later episodes where Chase gets burnt, and very heavily burnt, and they had this incredible makeup and suit that she put on that's a full body burn. And her daughter, I remember her getting all of the burn makeup, and then she's walking back to her trailer. And Pavan, her husband, was standing there with Sequoia, the baby. And the baby saw mum and reached out, but then saw all the burn makeup and recoiled at the same time as she was reaching out. So the arms are reaching to her mum, but her mum is horrifically burned and she's recoiling. I was like,
Oh.
well, that must be so confusing for a little baby. I mean, the baby doesn't know what burns are, doesn't know what the injuries were, but the makeup was so incredible on that show across the board. But yeah, in answer to your question, I think he would have probably, in the same way he does in the series, to choose the more diverse and personality driven Krista.
Do you enjoy in your career playing villains?
Yeah, I mean, I've made a career out of almost exclusively playing villains, so it's they're just way more fun. I mean, it's like the leading character is a really difficult role to play, because essentially, as a lead character, you're a blank canvas for the audience to imprint their ideas on, because everybody wants to empathize, understand, and that's the protagonist that's following you through the story. The antagonist, the rules are thrown out the window. You can kind of do whatever you want. You can mustache twirl if you feel it needs it. You can be deliciously evil if you want. You can be derisive. You can. It doesn't matter if the audience and like you or don't like you. Blade was one of the ones, but I also did a show called Sleepy Hollow where I played the embodiment of the Headless Horseman.
Oh yes, the Headless Horseman.
And it was one of the things we played around with a lot there, because initially in the show, obviously you're only seeing the actual Headless Horseman, and then through the power of magic, you get to see his head restored, and that's me, and we're playing this character. And they initially wanted him just to be the personification of evil, and I was like, I don't think that's interesting. Nobody, no thing is the personification of evil. Every evil, in quotations, person throughout history has always been justified in their own opinions. And if you can
They're the
tap
hero
into
of their
what,
own story.
exactly, yeah. And if you can tap into what that justification is, then it gives them depth and embodiment. I mean, it's like, it's, nobody is Michael Myers who just, single-mindedly wants to destroy. And I said, I think it's more interesting if he's that destructive because of his anger that's born out of something else that we flesh out in the show and talked about. And for me, I always love the idea of conflicting audiences. If you've got the villain who you're supposed to root against because you're rooting for the protagonist, and yet you start to understand why the villain is like that, and you start to like the villain, when they ultimately come head to head, it causes this delicious conflict because you obviously want to root for the hero, but at the same point, you're kind of rooting for the villain at the same time, and we'll see what happens with it. And as we all know, every hero is only as good as the villain they're up against. And if the villain is weak, or if the villain doesn't seem formidable, there's no crisis for them to overcome. The villain wants to seem more powerful and more in tune and more intelligent and more formidable than the hero to make that hero's journey worthwhile so that you get the payoff at the end. And so, yeah, they're just normally way more interesting.
I mean,
And yeah.
you got to play you played villains in the both Marvel Universe and the DC Universes. You were Icicle on Stargirl, a Nazi too. one of the big enemies of the JSA. That was like I was like God, I was watching that first episode and I was like, Jesus Christ, this guy looks so familiar. Where have I seen him from? And it was driving me crazy until I looked up and I was like, oh, he was the vampire on Blade.
And that's a Blade connection, because Geoff Johns came on and wrote
Yes.
several episodes. He was one of the
And he is the creator of Stargirl based off his late sister. Yeah.
exactly. And so we'd stayed in contact. We stayed in contact for several years afterwards, and then just life kind of disappears a little bit. And then I watched him become what he became, because he ended up taking over the DC Universe, and he was integral in all of the Zack Snyder DC projects, because he was overseeing DC over at Warner Brothers there. And then just got a call out of the blue. It was interesting. Nelson Lee, who played Shen in Blade, I went. He's a dear buddy of mine. We went for breakfast one day, and he said, "I just got a new job." And I was like, "Oh, what's the job?" And he said, "I got a call from Geoff Johns. He's finally got his Stargirl up and running as a TV series, and he's got it in the Berlanti universe. So it's going to be part of that. And I'm coming on to play Dragon King." I was like, "Oh, that's amazing. Oh, that's fantastic."
Wow.
So he was Dragon King in Stargirl,
Oh my God, I missed
and that
that. With
was,
considering he's under makeup, it's hard to
I
see.
know, yeah, he's got quite a bit of makeup on, and then 3 days
Wow.
later, I got a call from Jeff and just said, "Hey, we got this role that I'd love you to come in for, and I'd love you to do." And he sent me, I said, "Send me the script, I'd love to read it." Sent me the script, and I read the first few pages of where my character arrives, and I was like, this is going to be so much fun. And to be back on set with Jeff, and to be back on set with Nelson Lee, that was a little Blade reunion. The first day that Nelson was filming on Stargirl was a scene with my character, and Geoff Johns wrote that episode, and because he's a showrunner, he was always around. So we actually I asked if they would clear the set before we shot, and we came on the set and we actually had a little cry. It was like, this has been 15 years since we've shared a set together, the three of us, since Blade, maybe longer. I don't know what the math, 18 years. And we had a little hug and a little cry, and how cool is this that we get to do this still together? So yeah, that Stargirl was all through the Blade connections.
That's fantastic. You have to, if you are good friends with Nelson, we try to reach out to his website or people as well. Please
Oh,
pass
yeah.
on to come on the show. We would love to have him.
I will do. I will do. Yeah.
Because this interview will play when we're done with the show. His will probably play somewhere in between. So we have
Okay.
somebody else coming on possibly from Blade as well. We haven't recorded it quite yet, but
Oh, nice.
yeah, so we're almost about to land Larry Poindexter to come on, who was the cop
Oh,
investigating Blade.
yeah.
So
He just had Larry's such a lovely guy, and he just had twins as we were shooting, so he was, and it worked for his character so well. I'm sure you could talk about this with him when you do it, and by all means say that I said so. His
yeah.
character was supposed to just be exhausted, and it worked because he was just exhausted. Like, he would fly up, and then the moment he was able to go back to LA, he'd go back to LA and be twin dad, and then come back and come back again. And it just worked in his character. He was just permanently just, oh, God. So, yeah, he's a wonderful guy.
What did you think of
So,
the amount of? Oh, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to ask a very different question here. So if the Blades, the series were rebooted, if Marvel wanted to bring back this chestnut, would you want to come back and play Marcus again, or would you choose someone else?
I'd love to play Marcus again. I mean, I kind of always had it in my head that we were going to do a second season. I mean, so the, it there were, it seemed like a no-brainer to me. People really liked the show. We took a little bit to find our feet. I thought the pilot they did a really good job with. Then they got a new showrunner on board for the next two episodes. That showrunner was trying to find the world, and I think that they lost some of the action in episodes two and three. And then they switched. David Goyer came back and started show running, started injecting a lot more of the action back into it. I think by episode five, they found their feet. And there's some incredible work and incredible episodes in there. Like, I personally, episode 10, I always remember, I love what they did with the backstory of Marcus, of showing the way that he was turned and what happened to him, and how he ended up becoming into this world. The fact that he had a lover that was killed, and he was lost, and so there's rage behind it, and it just justified everything they'd done. And Geoff Johns wrote a wonderful standalone episode about a serial killer who was emulating a vampire and killing people. So they did these little bottle episodes, and it was all very new and very inventive for then. Now we look at superhero shows, and it's kind of what they do often with flashbacks and things like that, but people weren't doing that back then. I think they were ahead of their time, and if they were to reboot it, it'd be fun to come back and play Marcus again. Although he's not supposed to age, and I've definitely had 20 years on this face, so
Oh,
maybe
you
they'd have
still
to.
look great.
Thank you, thank you. That's what we'll just do it with filters. We'll stick a couple of filters on him.
This is the question everyone's having for Buffy the Vampire Slayer's return, being like, how is what's his name gonna play Angel and Spike? How is
Oh,
that even gonna
Angel.
happen? They don't look like the same. And I'm like, yeah, that's
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll address that when the show comes around. So
Yeah, they'll find a way of doing it. They lost their powers for a couple of years and then got them back again.
something like that. Were you shocked about the amount of like sex and violence on this show? Because we're watching it on the DVD and it's like unfiltered. Like there is a lot of tits and there's a lot of blood.
I'm not shocked, because that's the films. And the people that were making the TV series were not only aficionados of the project, but they came from the films. I mean, it was David Goyer who wrote the films, who now brought it to life on TV and had all the support of Marvel. And so I think they were really trying to honor the legacy, and they were really pushing the boundaries. And they needed somebody like Spike TV, one of the cable companies, to do it, because you're never going to get that show on network TV, definitely back then. It was too racy, too salacious, and too much gore. But you can't make a Blade without there being blood. I mean, it's like one of the most iconic scenes in comic book history and possibly film history, I think, is that shower scene in the first Blade. I mean, that's just incredible when they go to the club and suddenly the sprinklers come on.
Oh, it's
And
amazing.
yeah, and you realize what's going on in there. And then into that mist, you put Blade. I'm like, what an introduction to a character. It's perfect. So you can't go from that being the way that we perceive the character to a lot more mainstream PG-13 version on TV. It had to carry that thread through. And I know it was constant meetings going on with the network of, are we pushing it too far? Can we push it further? Where can we go with it? But yeah, we all got bathed in a reasonable amount of sticky syrup blood over the course of those episodes.
Did you have any interaction with the fans after the show was over?
We had a little, I mean, because social media didn't exist back then, so there wasn't the immediate interaction with the fans. The first time I mean, you're filming it and you're caught up in it. And I always think that everything I'm filming is going great and people are going to love. The first time I got a real sense that this might have something that people really enjoy is when we went to Comic-Con. It was my first ever time going to Comic-Con, and we were Hall H and we had the whole panel of us there, and they showed a clip before it had been released, and watching the hundreds and hundreds of people in Hall H lose their minds when they saw TV Blade doing what we'd done, and then the litany of questions afterwards, and then we signed for maybe an hour and a half afterwards, and we had to cut off. There was more and more people wanting to come up and sign, and they hadn't seen it yet. So that's just the love of the characters and the franchise that had been built and the little that they'd seen from the clips. And then when the show got released, we started getting little tastes of people and what it meant to them coming through. And since I've done Comic Cons for the various different stuff that I've done that's been genre, and there's always multiple people who are coming up from the Blade universe and talking about what that meant to them and how much they loved the show and how they wish there was a second, third, fourth season, and the world was just starting to get delicious before it was cut. So there's a lot of love out there, which is very lovely to hear.
That's
good. That's excellent. And I'm sure if you went to Comic-Con, like, you know, like this weekend, which is San Diego Comic-Con's happening, there'd be plenty of, you know, Blade fans. And of course, you probably went to Comic-Con for Stargirl and stuff like that, because, you know, that was obviously
I've done
big.
A couple, but not really, because you have to think about when Stargirl came out was beginning of COVID.
Oh, right. Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
Everything. I actually haven't been to a Comic Con since COVID, because everything shut down.
To get you on top of that, you got
it was
the,
just one of
you got that comic
kind of,
cred.
Yeah, we're just falling off the bandwagon with it. But it was that point where we should have been doing all the Comic Cons and really being out there, and it's that stuff that I love. It's just, you know, we make the shows and we're sequestered in our groups while we're making the show, and you're doing the best you can, and we're all focusing on that end point of how to make these moments and these characters work the best they possibly could. Going out to the Comic Cons and seeing what it means to people. I did a Comic Con years ago, and I have the thing in my drawer. I was doing some signings, and there was a young woman, maybe early 20s, who was walking away to the front. She got to the front. She just said, she kind of stammered and was very awkward and kind of caught off. And I signed the thing, and then she left. And it was just a sweet little exchange. And then 20 minutes later, she'd lined back up again. And she got to the front. I was like, oh, you again. Hello. She said, sorry, I got so flustered when I met you. I wanted to give you this, and I forgot to give you this. And she gave me a little postcard. And she said that both her parents had died 3 years earlier. And the only thing that got her through the death of both her parents from a car crash, and it was written on this little postcard, and it was a low-key postcard, was watching a show that I'd done back to back to back to back to back to back to back. And she said, just watching that on repeat helped me get through the death of my parents. She'd scuttled off, and I read it after I'd done the thing, and I went out into it, and I was like, let me see if I can find her, because this is just beautiful. And I was crying and I managed to find her, and we had a little moment. We sat down, had a little drink together, and had a little cry. And I'm like, how gorgeous is it that meant so much to somebody? Because you never know what the show is going to be, the life that it's going to have. And we all have those. I've got multiple shows that me as a kid growing up and me as an adult have meant so much to. But to actually get to interact with the people that made it and share that is amazing. So you're right. I need to get on the Comic-Con train again.
Definitely. Hey, Neil, thank you so much for coming on. We're pretty much at some. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Very
thanks
welcome.
For
nice to
everything
meet you
you've
both.
Done. Thank you so much. Yes, hopefully we'll see you at a Comic-Con here on the East Coast someday, or just any in general.
Thanks so
thank
much.
Thank you so
and
much
best
for
of luck
coming
to you
on
both.
The show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's nice meeting you both.
Good luck on your JFK project.
Thank you. Thank you. We've got one more day left. Yeah, we've got amazing people in it. John Travolta, loads of people. So it's a good one.